up next on the SRI 360 podcast.
If we're worried about the climate crisis, we should also be worrying about the biodiversity crisis. We're in the sixth global extinction. Our entire global GDP relies on nature. Investing in nature-based carbon projects is the single biggest way to finance nature protection right now. My job is to create impact strategies for those really core timberland assets, try to, at scale, deliver benefit for water, for species, for biodiversity, for climate. It's important to be proximate to the impact that you're trying to have so that you understand the challenge of execution. I think the recognition of biodiversity loss as a material financial risk to the global economy is another trend that's driving this interest.
Unlock the potential of your investments to improve the world and make high-performance returns. Welcome to Sustainable and Responsible Investing 360. My name is Scott Arnell, and each week I sit down with a world-class investor to uncover their secrets of profitable ESG, impact, and socially responsible investing. Find out more at SRI360.com. Today, I'm speaking with Charlotte Kaiser, the head of impact finance at BTG Pactual's Timberland Investment Group, where she's overseen an impressive $6 billion investment portfolio. Through her studies in environmental science at Harvard and Yale, a background in community development banking, and a 13-year run at The Nature Conservancy's NatureVest, Charlotte has reached the forefront of leveraging timberland investments not only for production outcomes and financial returns, but also for water, biodiversity, and climate protection. Under her leadership, the Timberland Investment Group, or TIG, has not only grown in assets, but has also deepened its commitment to generating sustainable impact through innovative forestry investments. These initiatives are designed to balance production forestry with conservation, aiming to create a symbiotic relationship that benefits the planet, people, and investors alike. Charlotte's work involves crafting and executing impact-focused transactions and developing partnerships that bridge the gap between for-profit motives and for-purpose conservation goals. Join me today as we explore how Charlotte is steering the future of impact investing through sustainable forestry. Thank you for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.
Where is TIG headquartered? Is that New York? I mean, I know the company is overall Brazilian, but you're not in Brazil.
No. Timberland Investment Group, or TIG, is a subsidiary of BTG Pactual, which is the largest investment bank in Latin America, with headquarters in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Our largest office is in Atlanta. It's where our fund services and back office team work from. And then we have another large office in New York City, which is where our client relationships team is based. And then we are kind of all over, close to the assets, primarily with colleagues in Arkansas, Georgia. And then, of course, all of our asset manager teams are located close to the assets themselves. And I happen to be in Missoula, Montana.
You moved out there a few years ago?
Yeah, we moved out full-time 4 years ago. We've been coming for summers since 2015.
You are an East Coast woman, right? I mean,
yeah.
You grew up in Washington, D.C., is that right?
I did. That's right. Right inside the city from age 2 until I left for college.
And then you went to Sidwell Friends School in Washington, which, as far as I know, is a Quaker school. So tell me all about that.
Yeah, Sidwell's become famous for being the alma mater of a number of presidents' daughters, but I was there before any of that. And it was a small Quaker, it remains a small and Quaker education institution. So Quakerism is a sect of Protestantism that doesn't have a clergy. The core belief of Quakerism is that there is that of God in every man, and that is, we witness that as people's inner light. And Quakers worship by gathering together in silence, bringing each of their little pieces of God together into a room. And the idea is that brings God present in that place of worship. And then people are moved to speak by that presence. And so there can be messages shared during the course of Quaker meeting. I, of course, went to Quaker meeting from first grade through high school. Nothing was shared whatsoever by the second, third, fourth, fifth graders, as you can imagine. But once we got to high school, it actually became a really dynamic place of connection and community. So it was a really formative experience for me. The other big kind of belief of Quakers are very social justice oriented. They're pacifists. They're all conscientious objectors. The practicing Quakers are and were abolitionists in during the Civil War period. So very, very focused on social justice, which is also very important for me.
Every time anyone goes through the history of socially responsible investing, you always get dragged through initial Quaker investment practices.
Yep.
As being kind of the origin, although I did interview Patrick Drum, who's got Islamic investment fund, who claims the Islam was the original. But did you go to Sidwell because you are Quaker or your family's Quaker, or is it because it's a good school and protection from the public school system or something like that?
I don't know if it was protection, but when I grew up in downtown Washington, D.C. in the 70s and 80s, and the district, the D.C. public schools at that time were fairly uneven. And my preschool years were with a Montessori school, like a very community organized school. And I learned to read before the first grade. And so when I was looking to the school, there was only a preschool that stopped after kindergarten. And so when my parents were looking to put me into school, the District of Columbia Public Schools were going to have me go straight into second grade. And that was something they didn't think was right for me. So we went to private school.
Glad you explained that, because at first you said you learned to read before the first grade. And so I thought you were going to say you started to do research and decide.
No, not at all. Not at all.
You became interested in conservation at a quite early age. So explain that to me. Was that the schooling, or is there a bigger picture there in your environment?
Both in my family and at Sidwell, there was a real commitment to an orientation towards service, that your life was, one's life is meaningful in so far as one is in service of a bigger idea or to others. And, you know, my father is a journalist. My mother is an anthropologist who worked in alternative sentencing and criminal justice when I was growing up. And then at Sidwell, we had service days. And the whole orientation was around being a participant in the world in service of making it better. And so one was always, or at least I was always thinking kind of, well, what would that look like for me? And then I think I was in middle school. I had an extraordinarily talented pair of science teachers who got me very excited about the natural world and about conservation and the environment. And so that sort of locked me into that career path in some form or fashion pretty early on. But of course, I had no idea what that would look like. And indeed, you know, something I tell people who ask me for career advice is, for the last 15 years, I've held jobs that didn't exist before I took them. And so, you know, kind of setting your sights on a particular role is maybe not the best thing to do, but instead to think about, what are the things you want to think about? What are the problems you want to solve? Who are the people you want to be around? And like help that, have that shape your career trajectory. But yeah, it's been a passion of mine since I was 14 years old.
After Sidwell, then you went off to Harvard to study environmental science and public policies.
Well, it's interesting. So Harvard was late to the game on creating a concentration or a major in environmental science. So I think I'm the first or second class that graduated with that major. So when I first came, I thought, well, maybe I'll do biology, but maybe I'll also do policy, because I was interested in all the different, you know, there's the foundational kind of understanding of ecosystems and conservation, and then there are the ways to affect change. I was very excited that they created this major that allowed me to kind of bring all of that together and not specialize particularly in a science focus or a different focus.
You graduated somewhere around 1996, and then your first job was in the rainforest of the Indonesian Borneo, where you ostensibly lived in a house with no plumbing.
That is true. So I was part of a project that was in a portfolio funded by USAID, the U.S. government, that was managed through something that no longer exists called the Biodiversity Conservation Network, which was a consortium of environmental conservation organizations, including the Nature Conservancy, World Wildlife Fund, and World Resources Institute. And there were about 20 different projects across Asia that focused on linking community development and economic well-being of communities to environmental protection. And so it was things like establishing ecotourism operations or creating, you know, beekeeping businesses. And then our project was focused on developing a community sawmill and logging operation in the buffer zone of a national park. And so we were working with local villagers to try to stand up a business. It was an interesting time because it was the end of the Suharto regime and the beginning of democracy in Indonesia. And so those exogenous factors made it very hard for us to kind of drive forward an innovative program just in terms of, you know, getting the attention of the relevant public officials to actually help us deliver. So we didn't get very far in terms of execution on the project, but I learned a ton about what it is to be living on the edge of a protected area and what distance and kind of, you know, commodity dependent living is really like in the developing world. And I think it has informed my understanding of what's feasible for conservation and community development globally, and really cemented for me my lifelong interest in meeting people where they are and engaging stakeholders, whether that's community villagers in Indonesia who are logging in the forest, or pension funds who are trying to invest in a net zero portfolio. What are their needs and how do we meet them while also maximizing the benefit to the planet?
So what's the idea of living in a house with no plumbing?
Well, there just wasn't plumbing in the region. And I was living with a family. There was electricity. And yeah, the people had dug, you know, pit latrines or whatever it was they decided to do. In some villages, there was a single latrine that people shared and other people didn't use it. I mean, it's how a huge part of the world lives. And I'm really glad to have had that experience.
And somewhere in my notes, you've said that you think you're still, after all these moves in your career you've made, you're still largely doing the same thing.
Well, it's what I said earlier, right? It's about meeting people where they are, you know, kind of environmental health of the planet is where it is today because of the systems that we live in, right? Systems are designed to deliver the results that they're producing. What I realized living in Indonesia is, you know, these guys are cutting down wood in the forest because of reasons that make sense economically and socially. And so how do you meet that system where it is and change it or tweak it to deliver a different outcome? And so I've operated in all these different systems, but it's really always trying to ask that question.
Then around 2004, you decided to go back to school and went to Yale, first for an MBA and finance and strategy, but then almost looks concurrently, maybe a master's in environmental economics. Why did you go back to school and how did you focus on those two paths of study?
Yeah, well, so in between Yale and Borneo was a stint in New York City working for the Parks Department, doing community organizing of neighborhood groups, kind of taking care of local parks. And similarly there, it was really about meeting people where they are and figuring out what was the community need that got them engaged in open space and what made them advocates for open space or green space or natural areas, of which there's surprising amount in New York City. And someone who wants a career in environmental conservation is always got her eye on the Yale School of Environment. That's kind of the place to get the professional degree one needs to kind of keep moving. And it was a professor of mine from undergrad who suggested I think about pursuing a joint MBA and an environmental degree. And Yale has a number of these joint programs. They make it quite easy across the different professional schools to link architecture and business or public health and the environment or kind of anything you can imagine, law and the environment. And so you apply to both schools and you get into both schools and then you typically start at the business school. And so it was actually in the pursuit of that program that I got really interested in thinking about how finance, economics really drive environmental outcomes. It's one of the longer levers I can think of, policy obviously being the other, that can really change how we literally value nature and the environment, and as a result, you know, protect it better.
And then while you were at Yale, you took a case-based course and ended up going to Temple Inland Forest Products Company in Lifkin, Texas. So tell me that story.
Well, this is a funny full circle moment for me, because today at TIG, we are a shareholder in a company called Caddo Sustainable Timber, which is the legacy asset manager of that Temple Inland asset that I looked at as a student at Yale more than a dozen years ago, where we were working with Temple Inland executives to develop a recommendation for how they might monetize ecosystem services across the portfolio, whether that was wetlands or water quality or carbon sequestration. We went and walked around on the asset and made a big presentation in the very nice glass-walled boardroom in the forest. And then halfway through the semester, Carl Icahn raided the company and broke it up, because this is the era when all of the integrated forest products companies were breaking up, and it was the dawn of the TIMO industry. So now here I am working for a TIMO invested in that same asset. And some of the team who are managing it are legacy Temple Inland employees, and actually remember the bright-eyed and naive Yale kids who came down to present their ideas. So it's just a funny full circle moment for me.
And then after you got out of Yale, you became a vice president at Citibank, which sounds important. What did you do at Citibank in your first job out with your newly minted degrees from Yale?
So in 2007, coming out of graduate school, I was really, you know, I knew what I wanted to do, which was to invest against assets that delivered conservation benefit. And that just didn't really seem to exist as a job, much as I tried to find one. But I was also really interested in developing more kind of rigorous experience in finance. And so looking on Wall Street for ways I could do something approximate to that, I ended up in community development banking, which is a whole sector of finance that relies on a couple of pieces of legislation, the Community Reinvestment Act, the Low Income Housing Tax Credit, the New Market Tax Credit, small business association legislation as well, that works to drive capital into underserved lower income communities. And so it felt very analogous in terms of, you know, again, trying to tweak a system to meet the banks and investors' interests where they are, but create incentives that then also created value in their investing in these lower income or underserved communities. So I did a lot of affordable housing and small business lending deals, but my timing was pretty extraordinary. I started at Citi August 1st, 2007. Stock price was at its all-time high. Fast forward a year and a half, things are quite different. And so my career on Wall Street was shorter lived than I had hoped for. And I was part of the bloodletting at the end of 2008. And so that's when I ended up at the Nature Conservancy.
Tuition payments in the School of Hard Knocks.
Right.
That's probably the quickest and most practical class in economics 100%. That you'll ever have had.
Absolutely. I mean, trying to manage a portfolio of loans to small businesses in Detroit in an economic meltdown, I learned a ton. It was really good.
Then in 2009, you started a 13-year run at the Nature Conservancy, which is a non-for-profit. I guess I understand from your last comment what prompted that. You were looking for a job after the Great Recession. Tell me how you landed there. And I'd like you to explain exactly what is the Nature Conservancy and what do they do?
Yeah, so as you noted, I was looking for work and it was clear I was not going to get a job in finance at that moment in time. And the Nature Conservancy, which is the world's largest environmental conservation organization, it's got about 5,000 staff. It operates in more than 75 countries. It also began life as a land trust, buying land for permanent protection. So it's a very transaction-oriented, pragmatic, solutions-focused NGO. It is not an advocacy NGO. It is not a policy NGO. It is a deal-doing NGO, is how I would characterize it. And I had recently hired to be its new CEO, a man named Mark Tirsik, who had previously been at Goldman Sachs for a long time, and had his most recent role there had been the head of their environmental division, where he had overseen the first document published by Goldman Sachs acknowledging the risk of climate change to the bank's portfolio. So I was put in touch with Mark through a mutual connection. And he was trying to build out the capacity of the organization to do kind of business-oriented conservation work. So I was hired to launch a product that would allow people to lend money to the Nature Conservancy instead of give it to the Nature Conservancy. The organization has, I won't know the asset base at this point, but it's north of $6 billion and a AA credit rating from Wall Street. So the idea was to create kind of a retail debt product that would allow people to lend the organization money. This is at a time when people were quite skittish about philanthropy because, again, the bottom still hadn't hit in the market. And so the organization was looking for liquidity from a different source. So I launched this program, the Conservation Note Program, and raised about $60 million for the next few years through that. That's how I got to the Nature Conservancy. It felt like a place where innovation was rewarded. There was huge scale when you can think about, you know, the organization's footprint and opportunity to do new things and really try new ways to deliver outcomes that there's huge scale at the Nature Conservancy and opportunity to try new ways to deliver meaningful impact. And that's something I really have always loved about that organization is it's focused on very tangible results. So whether that's raising enough money to do really meaningful conservation or delivering science that allows for better decisions, it's very tangible.
What's the origin of the organization?
It was launched in 1951 by a number of scientists in New York who mortgaged their homes to buy a piece of land called Mianus Gorge in Westchester County, still there, still protected. And then they started trying to raise money to buy land to protect it forever. And then realizing that that was not going to get us where we need to go, it developed sort of an increasing number of programs around policy, around engaging with corporations. It became an international organization in the 90s. There's actually a great book about the history of the organization called Nature's Keepers, which tells the story of how it grew from small, a few hundred person NGO to now.
You started out as a manager there, but then eventually became the managing director of NatureVest, which was something very transaction-oriented. What led to the establishment of NatureVest, and what role did you play in setting that up?
Yeah, so in 2012, I think, the Rockefeller Foundation and JP Morgan issued a paper, Impact Investing, a New Asset Class. And one of the things that we learned in launching the conservation note is back then, socially responsible investing, the term impact investing hadn't been coined yet, right? In 2010, 2011, was almost exclusively focused on social and community impact. And putting the note into the market, people reacted very positively. Oh, I'd love, my values align to conservation. I love the idea that I can invest along with my philanthropy and deliver on my values. I've been looking for something in the environment space and investments forever. I'm so glad this is here. What else can you give us? And so the impact investing market grew. It sort of became this tide that lifted a strategy inside of the Nature Conservancy. What else can we do? We are transactional. We think about value. We think about structuring deals. What else can we do that wouldn't require philanthropy, but we could do with investment capital? And so we asked that question and secured inaugural funding from JP Morgan to build out a team that would answer it. So I was part of the team that founded NatureVest. We launched in 2014. I led the transactions team at that time. And then in 2018, took over the whole program.
I had Liesl Pritzker-Simmons of the Blue Haven Initiative on the show a few weeks ago, and I noted that she's on the board.
Yep.
There. What is the role of foundations there versus partnering with corporate entities?
NatureVest is a program of the Nature Conservancy. It is, the staff are all employees of the Nature Conservancy, and so they are funded largely philanthropically still today. So that money has come from corporations like JP Morgan and also foundations like the Grantham Foundation and the Julian Robertson Foundation, as well as individuals over the years. So, and the board is an advisory board and also a board of donors who help think about strategy and opportunities for engaging in different sectors globally. The head of Lucas Walton's Family Foundation is also on the board, right? And Lucas has been really forward thinking and in thinking about investing for impact across his entire portfolio, as has Liesl. I mean, Liesl is the OG impact investor. And so it's people like that who are at the cutting edge, kind of helping shape and support strategy.
NatureVest, which is also not for profit, ran into some controversy for partnering with the for profit. How do you call it? Is it TIG? Or how
TIG,
do you call yourself?
TIG, yeah.
TIG, yeah. I want to ask you about this because I want to talk about carbon offsets and the whole carbon offset industry. Can you explain that to me? Because I want to know how this works. Every time I buy an airline ticket on KLM or something, they ask me if I want to pay for this. And it seems like people have no idea where this money goes and what does it do. And there just seems to be so much smoke around all this. Can you explain this to me?
Sure. I want to set the record straight. So there was no controversy in our collaboration, in TNC's collaboration with TIG. There was some controversy. There's a journalist at Bloomberg Green, Ben Elgin, who wrote a piece kind of criticizing some of the carbon projects that the Nature Conservancy did, not that NatureVest did. So NatureVet's strategy evolved under my leadership to focus on these strategic partnerships with or strategic collaborations with fund managers and fiduciaries. There's also a whole body of work that they do around sustainable debt and sovereign debt refinancing, which is extremely cool. But on the equity side, the focus is on these strategic collaborations. So there's one with a group called Renewable Resources Group, which does agriculture and water investing. And then the one we have at TIG with them. And then they also have one in aquaculture and one in ecotourism. There may be others in the works that I don't know about anymore. So I can talk a lot more about the structure of that. But in terms of carbon markets, there's a lot of noise. There's a lot of smoke. There's sort of two, I would say, there's two ways to think about carbon markets or carbon offsets in particular. One is that it's sort of a form of selling indulgences, right? Like you are an airline, you emit a lot of carbon, you make people feel good by offering the opportunity to buy offsets of their flight. But in the meanwhile, you're still emitting the carbon, right? So no real change has been made. Another way to think about offsets is that they are kind of an important piece of a much bigger decarbonization portfolio or puzzle. So I'll use the company Apple as an example. We at TIG are working with them. They have a fund called the Restore Fund that invests in carbon projects, and they have invested in some of our carbon offsetting strategies. Apple has now got zero emissions in its production in terms of all of its factories are supplied with renewable energy. They're working hard to make all of their materials totally recyclable or recycled. They're doing all that they can to have no emissions footprint in their operations. However, things like shipping and certain other inputs are continue to be emitting inputs in a way that they cannot control. And so to fully zero out themselves as a company, they also invest in carbon offsets. A carbon offset is a unit of carbon emission reduction that is additional to what would have otherwise happened without the money to pay for that offset. So for example, if somebody comes to you and says, I'll pay you to put solar panels on your house, but I get the carbon emission reduction that comes from that, that's a good example of something that's a change you make, right, as a result of this money coming in. And then this person can take the however much, you know, CO2 you emit as a homeowner, that reduction in emissions is a credit for them. So that, you know, if Walmart, you know, paid for everybody in America to have solar panels on their house, there'd be a lot less carbon emissions, and that could count against their emissions. You know, I think at scale, it starts to make some sense. However, we're never going to offset our way to a zero carbon future. There needs to be real emission reductions alongside offsets. The key part about offsets that come from nature, so forest carbon or soil carbon or anything else, is that they offer an opportunity to, at scale, pay for restoration and conservation that otherwise doesn't exist. So if we're worried about the climate crisis, we should also be worrying about the biodiversity crisis. We're in the sixth global extinction. Our entire global GDP relies on nature. And so investing in large-scale, credible, real, nature-based carbon projects is the single biggest way to finance nature protection right now, which we also need to do. So I'm a big believer in carbon offsets as a tool for nature protection. I'm obviously also a big believer in making sure they're real and reliable and durable, because a viable market relies on trust. I mean, people need to trust that the emission reductions are real. And so I think the controversy is, it's important to make sure that you trust what you're paying for. And I think the controversy is a little bit misplaced when you think about the actual scale of what's going on.
You referred to a unit of carbon reduction. What is that?
It's a ton of carbon dioxide equivalent. That's the unit that trades. So, you know, you think about a tree grows, it sequesters carbon, it takes carbon out of the air and turns it into wood, right? And you can calculate based on annual growth rates and what the species is, how much carbon an oak tree will sequester in 10 years. And if instead of harvesting that tree in 10 years, you let it grow for 20 years, you're sequestering additional carbon that you can be paid for through a voluntary market. As long as when you cut it down, you then need to turn it into something that stays as wood. You obviously can't set it on fire.
When they calculate the unit of carbon reduction for whatever it is, for solar panels, like the example you give. Is there somehow an offset to that that's related to the manufacturing of the panel and the mining of the heavy metals or whatever all goes into that, and the ultimate disposition of it at the end of its life cycle? And is that all real, or is it kind of voodoo?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I don't actually know the answer to that, because typically what happens is, if you have solar panels on your roof, right, you're not drawing electricity from the grid. And where I live in Montana, that's coal, our grid. So the calculation, as I understand it, is only comparing the emissions of household, right, with solar panels, which is zero, against the emissions of the household drawing from a coal-fired power plant. I don't think in either case is the kind of carbon impact of the mining of the coal or the carbon impact of the production of the solar panel calculated. It's just the kind of point emission reduction that's factored in. If you want to go down a deep rabbit hole, you can start reading about the Greenhouse Gas Protocol and how emissions are calculated. Because, for example, right, that coal, whose emissions are those? Is that mine as the homeowner? Is that Northwest Energy as the utility? Or is it the coal mining company's emissions, right? And so there's actually this idea of scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. Scope 1 are your emissions in your business. So as Northwestern Energy, it's the pipe, basically, as well as the trucks and the emissions that are produced by you. Scope 2 is the emissions of your users. So that's, me plugging in things in my house. And then scope 3 is emissions. For example, Walmart's scope 3 emissions include whether or not we wash the clothes we bought there in hot water. And so in terms of creating a science-based target for emission reductions, companies are asked to focus on scope 1 and scope 2, because those are the things they can directly control. But everybody's scope 3 emission is somebody else's scope 1 emissions, right? Like that hot water decision is my, as a human, as a household owner, scope 1 emission. So it's very complex. And that is why there can be room for, even kind of good faith actors to mess up in doing this calculation. There are pretty intricate rules and a whole slew of rule setting bodies that are trying to make this work.
Well, I just thought I would take advantage and ask.
Sure.
As someone who will never read that, I thought I would ask someone who probably has read it and has an informed opinion. I get into the same discussion when we talk about electric cars and energy storage in batteries, because there's all these batteries, and I feel like we get into this voodoo finance on what's the implications of the mining of the heavy metals and the disposition of the heavy metals.
We got to pick our poison. I mean, that's the bottom line.
The Nature Conservancy is partnering with companies like JP Morgan Chase, which I think I'm right when I say is the largest global funder of fossil fuels.
Yep, you're right.
Achieve their biodiversity and climate change goals. And the Nature Conservancy is this kind of giving people like JP Morgan a brand benefit and somehow kind of a green sellout?
It's a fair question. And the answer isn't always obvious or straightforward. I mean, I think one of the things, so there's a principles-based answer, which I really believe in, which the Nature Conservancy holds, which is it is better to work with these companies and meet them where they are and move them than it is to ignore them or wish they went away or fight them. And I think that is true. And then, of course, how it operates in real life day to day is another question. And I think I know at the Nature Conservancy, they have very good lawyers really focused on ensuring that any collaboration with a private entity was not creating undue private benefit, and that it was delivering really meaningful conservation impact. So the idea being you can do more if it is the case that you can do more for conservation through a collaboration without creating undue private benefit, then it is worth it to do. And so I think taking the funding from JP Morgan, does it create a halo effect for them, in real life? Certainly it does. Were we able at NatureVest to protect hundreds of thousands of hectares of ocean and hundreds of thousands of acres of land through transactions that we structured thanks to JP Morgan funding? Also, yes. And which is worth more? I would say the conservation benefit is worth more than the kind of halo. And therefore, kind of the trade is worth it.
That being said, you sat on both sides of the table. Do you step back and worry about greenwashing?
I mean, in general, yeah. In that instance, no. I also think there's a really important role. I think the environmental nonprofit community is an ecosystem with everybody playing their role, right? And I think banks like JP Morgan are excited to work with the Nature Conservancy because the advocacy organizations are pushing them to do more. And then the Nature Conservancy offers kind of a pragmatic way for them to do more. So I think there's a role for everybody to play in keeping us all honest.
In 2022, you left the Nature Conservancy for the Timberland Investment Group in BTG Pactual. What was your motivation? How did that move come about? And I guess you came and are the head of impact finance there, right?
Yeah. So I'd been at TNC for 13 years, which is the longest stint I've done anywhere, and really loved it and was really proud of what we had accomplished at NatureVest and what we had built. And it was starting to feel like the wheels were on the bus and the bus was driving and maybe it was time for a new adventure. And I knew the TIG team because of the collaboration that we had set up the year before, where the Nature Conservancy is the conservation advisor on our North America strategy. And so when I was looking around for who else was doing cool things in the space, they were a very obvious phone call. And so we talked about my joining. We developed this new role, head of impact finance, where I'm now in charge of creating an impact strategy for the whole portfolio, as well as managing the relationship with the Nature Conservancy, which is, of course, really fun for me to continue to work with my former colleagues very closely. So it made it a very easy and happy transition.
If you could provide me a high-level introduction to BTG Pactual, just paint the big picture and then say, where does TIG fit in that? And then tell me about TIG and what your mission is and what you're trying to do with impact investment strategies.
So BTG Pactual is the largest investment bank in Latin America, headquartered in Brazil. It has all of the functions that an investment bank has. And we sit within the asset management division as an independent subsidiary. TIG, the sort of original company, was called Equator and was founded in 2007 by four partners who all still work for the company to invest in forest management and environmental products. Became a subsidiary of BTG in 2012 when they decided to move from forest management as a service to forest management as an asset owner in Latin America, where you're required to be a Brazilian entity if you want to own land in Brazil. And so that's the history of how TIG became sort of part of BTG. We operate fairly independently, and in 2013 acquired a portfolio of North America assets that became the base for the North America strategy we have today. So now we are about $6 billion in assets under management, makes us the third largest timber investment management organization after Manulife and New Forest. Although I think it's worth noting New Forest is about 50% ag, and that's exclusively the New World. So North America and Latin America, we have about 3 million acres, roughly 60-40 U.S. and Latin America. And our mission is to sustainably manage those timberlands in ways that exceed industry best practice and deliver positive outcomes for nature and climate. Most of what we own are very conventional working forests. In Latin America, that's pine and eucalyptus plantations. In North America, it's pine, hardwoods, and softwoods in the Pacific Northwest. And we are working, my job is to create impact strategies for those really core timberland assets to try to, at scale, deliver benefit for water, for species, for biodiversity, for climate. We are in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy on our North America portfolio. So that really gives us a huge kind of asset in terms of that organization's scientists, forest management experts, spatial analysts, to identify where across the footprint, we have about 1.1 million acre footprint, are the best opportunities for endangered species protection, water quality improvement, other biodiversity benefits. And then in Latin America, we also have a reforestation strategy in collaboration with Conservation International, where we are creating new forestry assets from degraded cattle pastures and restoring about 50% of that portfolio to native forest for permanent protection. So that's us.
You are an asset manager. Does that mean you have outside investors that invest, and then you're making and managing those investments? So are you a fund?
Yeah, we have a number of different investment strategies.
Who do you consider your competitors?
So you could think about competitors for capital, right? And so then that would be the whole forest investment management sector, New Forest, Manulife, which is formerly called Hancock Forest Investment Associates. There are a number of good other companies out there. And then competitors for assets, those who share our footprint. So that would be Forest Investment Associates, New Forest, and others who are in North South America.
And are you a certified B Corp?
No, we are not.
Can you explain the traditional role of forestry and investor portfolios? What's the attraction of the asset class and conservation finance?
So traditional timberland investing has always been appealing to people with very long investment time horizons. So pension funds in particular, it is an uncorrelated asset to inflation. So people see it as a hedge there and to the stock market. And so people see it as a good diversification strategy, as well as a good inflation hedge. It's generally cash yielding. Yields are not competitive with private equity, but they are competitive, have been historically competitive with public equities for the long term. And it's a real asset. So people who would like to have real assets in their portfolio and find forestry attractive. Of late, there's been a huge, as you know, shift in the global capital markets where $150 trillion has committed to being net zero by 2030 in the last 4 years. And I would say most of those investors don't know how to do that and have noticed that trees sequester carbon. And so there's a really burgeoning interest in timberland investing as a carbon sequestering investment relative to any other kind of major asset class. Growing trees and harvesting them takes carbon out of the air, and long-lived wood products keep it out of the air. So it becomes a very low carbon positive investment for investors who find that important. And then, of course, we're trying to do more than that in terms of having additional benefit for climate and biodiversity.
These last things you've mentioned are really the non-financial attractions of the asset class. So one thing I feel you're somewhat different or unique on is the impact aspect, because usually discuss real assets and forestry more in the context of sustainability, but you specifically are discussing impact, which technically there's some additional criteria. So how should impact investors think about an allocation to timberland?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I will say the sector, I think, is a very sustainable one. Our peers are all excellent in terms of sustainability. A long time ago that people wouldn't replant trees after harvesting them. Impact, as you say, is different. It's trying to create additional benefit to communities, to nature, to whatever constituency outside of, you know, good management and sustainable management. So I think investors who are thinking about impact should look at timberland investment managers, ask what is their impact strategy, what is their impact framework, and how are they delivering additional benefit beyond business as usual.
So then what is the circular bioeconomy and what will it become, you know, with this increased focus on biodiversity that you alluded to and the increased focus on nature?
In the early days of market economies and the capital markets, labor and money were very expensive and natural capital was free. And today we realize the cost of labor has gone down. The cost of money, while now higher, has gone down. But natural capital has a huge cost because it is finite. And so the circular bioeconomy values that natural capital and invests against it and for it in a different way. So as an example, traditional agriculture, industrial agriculture as it's practiced today, could be considered an extractive industry in terms of the soil impact, the water impact. Something like regenerative agriculture seeks to be a renewable industry, putting back soil quality, putting back water. And so the circular bioeconomy really relies on a renewable approach to resource use. One example that we're really excited about for obvious reasons is mass timber, which seeks to replace extractive materials concrete and steel in building so that buildings can become carbon sinks instead of emission machines, and can create increased demand for forest products, because the more demand there is for forest products, the more trees people will plant. And the more trees people plant, the more carbon comes out of the atmosphere, and the better for soil and water and biodiversity.
Is this the main trend that's driving interest in impact-driven timberland investment? Because I keep thinking, like, I just haven't understood the word impact used a lot with timberland investment.
Yeah. No, I think that's one of the big trends. I think this net zero trend is another very big trend, because, of course, traditional sustainably managed timber is not creating additional carbon sequestration. It's just sequestering the carbon that it does as an industry. And then I think the recognition of biodiversity loss as a material financial risk to the global economy is another trend that's driving this interest.
What is your impact strategy and your theory of change?
Probably the easiest way for me to answer that is to give an example and focus on our collaboration with the Nature Conservancy in North America, where we have, as I said, this core timberland portfolio really focused on execution, managing a set of assets for financial returns and sustainable output. And then we've brought in the Nature Conservancy to look at how we can, within the context of that strategy, deliver impact. Obviously, because of who they are, their focus is primarily on biodiversity and climate impact. So I'll just speak about those two here. So the Nature Conservancy has assessed this whole million in acre portfolio and seen, okay, here about 30% of this land is really important for biodiversity based on our analysis and our data sets. And within that 30%, here are the practices that you can put in place that really will benefit biodiversity in the context of working forests. So one example is in places where there's really important aquatic habitat, we're doing more with streamside management. We're creating wider buffers. We're retaining more trees in those buffers. We're buffering ephemeral streams, which are seasonal streams. And we're doing all of that under their guidance. Or in the Southeast, in pine forests, we're doing some uneven aged thinning as part of our management practice to create a diversity of light levels and a diversity of forest structure, which is really important for species that live in that forest. We're doing prescribed burning in fire-managed ecosystems in a way that targets really critical biodiversity hotspots in our portfolio that allows for restoration of native species to create, you know, more habitat. So those are examples of ways that in the context of a working forest portfolio, in the context of practices, we're harvesting trees, we're doing thinning, we're creating streamside management zones already, but we're tweaking those practices so that the biodiversity benefit can be optimized.
The way you described it sounded like you were talking about perhaps a pre-existing portfolio you had.
Yes, in that case, it's a pre-existing portfolio, yeah.
But I presume you're actively fundraising and deploying more capital, so you're looking for new targets. Is that a similar process?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in North America, we're fundraising. We'd like to grow the portfolio. And whenever we identify a potential new acquisition, the Nature Conservancy looks at that. There's a set of rules that we've both agreed to where we call the minimum acceptable standards, where, you know, they make sure that the asset meets those. And if it doesn't, we either shouldn't buy it or we should have a plan to bring it into compliance. And then beyond that, they're saying, you know, this is an opportunity for permanent protection. We can bring in some conservation finance here. Here are the management interventions we'd recommend you make. You know, this has the species on it. We're very excited about this. So then there's this preliminary development of some conservation strategies around that asset prior to acquisition. And then we can start rolling those out once it's in the portfolio. They're also kind of guiding us. They have created a map of where the biggest benefit is to keeping land in forest and where the biggest benefit is to having responsible forest landowners. And so as we're looking at, you know, obviously we're not in charge of what comes up for sale every year, but it helps us to know, you know, this is an area that they're very excited about. Let us keep going after this asset because the benefit's going to be greater.
Do you have any kind of impact screen that you apply that are up front and foremost when you evaluate potential investments alongside the financial criteria?
Yeah, it's these minimum acceptable standards that I described earlier that really focus on the asset delivering benefit as a timberland asset and not doing any harm. And then, so it clears that hurdle. We still haven't made a decision if we're going to go after it or not, because if it didn't, we wouldn't. And then the Nature Conservancy will continue their pre-screen work. And there isn't a numeric target in the short answer to your question, but there is a assessment that's done of the opportunity for impact. And if there's greater opportunity, we are going to be, you know, assuming it clears our financial hurdles, all else being equal, that's an asset that we're going to want to pursue more than one that has less opportunity for impact.
And is your investment strategy different in the different regions internationally that you work in?
Oh, good question. So outside of the U.S., our core timberland portfolio, we're really primarily focused on assets at scale where we can, you know, manage at scale. And we develop an impact strategy post-acquisition. We also have a reforestation strategy where we are, as I said, in collaboration with Conservation International. And there it's similar, kind of a iterative, here's something that we could buy. Does it have good impact? You know, yes, you know, we kind of go work together with Conservation International to ensure that our portfolio is optimizing impact within our financial hurdles.
Is there any acquisition that you could describe how you viewed it in terms of impact, how you got to the decision to pull the trigger on it?
I can give a negative example. So we were looking at an asset for sale in the U.S. that was somewhat outside of our core geographies in terms of, you know, we're trying to keep our assets somewhat clustered for management efficiencies. But we showed it to the Nature Conservancy because we thought if they found it very exciting from an impact perspective, we would push harder to go after it because we would have an opportunity to deliver more impact. Turned out they were not excited about it. And so we walked away. But that's an example of how our impact priority would have, you know, affects our acquisition behavior, if that makes sense.
Well, that's a very Quaker approach. So you've been schooled well. Tell me then, how are you measuring impact? Because this is kind of the $64 million question, whether I'm talking about real assets or someone building housing. There's lots of impact funds and people looking to have impact. And I guess in your case, how do you ensure that planting forests and environmental surveys and all this are improving overall nature and the biodiversity outcomes?
I'll talk about our reforestation strategy because we're already seeing a lot of impact. We've launched that strategy a year ago. We've made a number of acquisitions. We're already doing restoration on the ground, and Conservation International is supporting the monitoring and verification of our impact there. So it's a very robust monitoring process that I would have to dig into some materials to give you real specifics on, but we're doing things like assessing the income of the communities around us to see if they are increasing relative to a baseline. We are obviously counting the number of jobs that are being created. And then from a biodiversity standpoint, we have camera traps. We're doing water quality assessment twice a year. We're assessing carbon sequestration through the tree growth. There's going to be other monitoring that comes online as the asset base grows, but we're already seeing really interesting results from the camera traps in terms of species that are showing up as the restoration matures. So a lot of very kind of direct, you know, non-modeled, non-sensed monitoring to ensure that we're really delivering the impact that we were aiming for.
You're speaking with a layman now. Is a camera trap what it sounds like? Like these are cameras you set up in the forest and then observe what animals?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we've seen a jaguar, which was quite cool. So yeah. Yeah. There are night ones and day ones depending, you know, to track different species. And yeah, that's exactly right.
I guess climate change is a major risk to forestry and land management. What are the main risks and how are you managing those risks?
Currently, basically, the main risk is that the rainfall and temperature regime of the region where we have assets could shift in such a way that it would no longer support the species that were growing there. And so that's actually analysis that we do when we do a new acquisition in our reforestation strategy. And it's analysis we're going to have in place across the portfolio, which is, you know, looking at kind of worst case scenario, business as usual, a decent scenario and kind of middle of the road. What are the projections for rainfall and temperature in this region in 40 years, in 70 years? And what is the viability of the species that we're growing today based on those projections? That's one piece of analysis that we do. Obviously, the risk of fire is something that people think about all the time. And we're seeing, obviously, increased fire intensity and frequency here in the United States and elsewhere in the world, Chile. And so just as an asset owner, we're very, very focused on fire risk management. And we have a collaboration with our neighboring landowners, especially in Latin America, where the assets are much more contiguous and tight. And so pretty sophisticated fire monitoring technologies that we share with our neighbors to ensure that any fires are quickly spotted and quickly dealt with. But it's worth noting too, just on the fire front, that managed forests are much less likely to burn in general because they are managed. So fire risk is a combination of two things: heat and temperature, dryness, which is definitely something we don't control and is increasing with climate change, but then also fuel load, which is something we do control. And in a managed forest, you don't have the dead trees on the ground and the big fuel load that is what drives these mega fires. You have roads going throughout that act as natural fire breaks. So our risk increase as a result of these other factors is going to be less in a managed forest, but we're paying attention to all of the different inputs that could drive risk there.
Can you guys help out California a bit?
It's a very challenging, environment. Yeah.
So looking at the big picture, I've seen statistics that somehow sustainable forestry can be 30% of the solution. But then I've also seen that like only 3% of capital is going into this. If so, why so little is being invested in nature-based solutions?
It's such a good question. It's a pretty small asset class, right? If you think about it, we are $6 billion and we're third largest. The total investable universe today is not that big compared to other asset classes. And some of that is due to demand for forest products. And so as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we're really excited about and a big advocate for is additional uses for forest products, particularly in the building industry. The building industry would be the fifth largest emitter of carbon in the world if it were its own country. And so really, it's 40% of global carbon emissions, I believe. So solving that has the kind of triple benefit of reducing the emissions from production of coal and steel, sequestering carbon forever by using wood products instead, and driving demand for more forest, for more reforestation, which further sequesters more carbon. I think that's one of the reasons. I think another reason is that nature-based solutions in general are often not at scale. They're very, my experience in Indonesia tells me, right, working with these local communities, these resource-dependent communities, it's not something that is lends itself to a kind of capital market scale intervention. And so trying to bridge that gap is something that the Nature Conservancy and others are working on. I will say that our reforestation strategy is going to be the largest ever private reforestation project in the world. And so, you know, we're trying to do our part to solve the scale problem, but it's definitely going to be a kind of silver buckshot, many, many bites at the apple approach that's going to be needed to really get us to where we need to be.
Climate change is not just about carbon emissions, which seems to be where a lot of the conversation is focused, and not just about temperature rises, but also about the risk of biodiversity collapse. How do you balance the need to deliver financial returns to investors using commercial forestry with biodiversity and ecosystem recovery?
It is what we're actively trying to do with the Nature Conservancy, thinking about, you know, how do we not just sustain where we are, but regenerate and improve the ecosystems where we operate. And the practices I described earlier are good examples of how we're doing that. And I think it's really taking a more long-term and holistic approach to thinking about portfolio management and asset management. Where is this ecosystem going to be in 25 years? Because we can no longer rely on it to be in the same place. because of climate change? And therefore, what are the practices we need to put in place today to ensure that it's still healthy and functioning so that we can continue operating and so that the species that we share it with can continue to thrive?
What about planting non-native commercial forestry? Because that doesn't necessarily represent ecosystem restoration or biodiversity.
It's a controversial question, and it's one that's been a hot topic lately in the carbon market world. In North America and in Europe, almost all commercial forestry uses native species. In Latin America, Asia, and Africa, almost no commercial forestry uses native species.
Why not?
In terms of producing wood fiber in a very efficient way, eucalyptus in Latin America is the best species to grow. You can grow a 100-foot eucalyptus tree in 12 years in Brazil. So if you think about a planet that needs wood for housing and wood pulp for toilet paper and, you know, all of the things that wood provides, very fast-growing, very well-managed plantation, production forests, assuming that the non-native species are not invasive, are not damaging, which has been proven in a 50-year-old eucalyptus timber industry in Brazil, efficiency of production of wood fiber actually reduces the threat to native forests of extraction, where they don't grow back quickly. People high-grade harvest out the valuable trees, damaging the ecosystem, damaging the integrity of the ecosystem. What we're trying to do is protect and restore natural forests and deliver wood products using production forests so that you reduce pressure on those biodiverse native systems and create the wood fiber we all need with these production.
What does competitive advantage look like in sustainable forestry?
It's a combination of factors. I think it's choosing well the assets that you own so that they can be as productive as possible, creating financial return while affording you the ability to deliver additional impact for biodiversity. I think that's a competitive advantage. I think excellent management of the forest is a competitive advantage, both from a production perspective as well as from a sustainability and impact perspective. If you're good at not creating pollution in the streams through runoff, if you're good at designing your roads so that they, have minimal impact on the environment, that's a competitive advantage. And I think being aware of one of our principles for impact is to be good neighbors, being aware of the communities that you operate in and their needs, working to support jobs they need, provide access to recreation that they need and benefit from, provide access to community services that they need and benefit from. Those are all, I would say, competitive advantages.
What role do you think technology will have and play in the future in sustainable forestry and other nature-based investments going forward?
I think technology has a huge role to play. I think particularly in the kind of monitoring and evaluation of impact, we're seeing a huge kind of explosion of innovation in technology. I'm really excited about acoustic monitoring. Ecosystems that are healthy sound different from ecosystems that are not. And you can really assess that acoustically in a very low cost and very kind of robust way. I think technology for inventory so that you can ensure you have accurate assessment of the trees that you have. We're piloting an interesting strategy with inoculating seedlings with mycorrhizae fungi to improve growth and soil health, which is a cool kind of biotechnology approach. So I think there's a lot of room. Timberland investing is a pretty old-fashioned industry in terms of management. We're using a lot of the same tools and techniques tried and true for decades. And so there is, I think, some room for innovation in the tech space for sure.
Charlotte, I've got a few last rapid-fire questions to wrap up our talk here. If you had to name the single most important challenge in the sustainable timberland asset management space at this time, what would it be?
Finding good deals.
Pipeline. What do you know now about impact investing that you wish you knew when you showed up at the Nature Conservancy in 2009? And what did you think was important then that you now know isn't?
Impact investors are fiduciaries. And so they have to deliver impact in the context of risk-adjusted returns. And that is something I've learned that is really, really important that I wish I had known. what I thought was important then was creative structures that maximized impact. What I have learned is that creativity within the framework of an understood investment model is the direction we need to go.
You don't have to name names, but can you describe to me an example of an investment that you were convinced of at the time you invested? And this can be at TIG, it can be at the Nature Conservancy, that it ticked all of your impact boxes, but in the end, it didn't turn out. And what did you learn? What was the lesson learned from that experience?
This kind of goes to my previous answer. This was a really cool deal in Africa, providing working capital to a small enterprise in the northern rangelands of Kenya to buy cattle from herders who practice better grazing practices to improve wildlife habitat. And we structured a forgivable loan, can't remember the amount, into this enterprise. And it was a great idea. And all kinds of things happened, including primarily they couldn't get access to markets to sell the beef. I learned the importance of how challenging it is to scale a tiny operation that had been funded by $1 million grant, 5X, in the middle of the remote rural highland rangelands of Kenya. The challenges of operating a business in that environment and how much harder it is than it looks.
I've heard many stories about how Africa is the graveyard of good intentions. And now the converse of that, can you describe an investment that you had some level of skepticism either at the time you invested or maybe you ultimately passed on? And in the end, it turned out way better than you thought and you were pleased you invested, or if you had passed, you wish you hadn't. And what did you learn from that experience?
An investment we did at the Nature Conservancy right before I left was something we partnered with Third Way to create a working capital fund, again, for ecotourism operators who were close to shutting down during COVID because of the complete drop-off in tourism. And the idea was, here's something to keep the lights on. In exchange for taking this capital, which was relatively low cost to them, here are some conservation and community covenants that we want you to put in place that will increase the benefit that your operation has on communities and ecosystems. And I've left, so I don't know how well the deal did, but I do know that they were able to raise a substantial amount of money and really put a lot of money to work in regions that desperately needed it at that time. But there was a lot of skepticism that we could move fast enough, that we would really make a difference, that these operators would change their behavior. And I think, you know, we should check with my successor at NatureVest. But I think it has been a big success, and the deal really, to me, that's the kind of creative structuring that really works.
And if someone wants to get into the sustainable conservation finance investment space, how would you advise them to get into the business?
I had a professor in college who gave me the best answer to this question when I asked him for his advice. He said, everyone is going to tell you, do what they did. And so I'm going to do that too. I think that it's important to be proximate to the impact that you're trying to have, at least at some point in your career, so that you understand the challenge of execution. I think one of the big potential drawbacks of impact investing writ large is that the capital is extremely well-intentioned and it goes into vehicles or ventures or enterprises that aren't actually delivering the impact they commit to. And the reason for that is people are very excited. There's a lot of money in the space, and people don't necessarily have the understanding of the challenges around execution. And so having that understanding really gives you a competitive advantage, makes you the smarter money, and that's always the money you want to be at the table, right?
Charlotte, you've been very generous with your time. I think we've about beat all these subjects to death this morning. I've really enjoyed it. I don't speak enough about real assets and real asset investing, and I've got to do more of it.
This is really fun. I hope you had fun too.
Yeah, no, I did. It's good subject matter, and I learned a lot from it, and I really appreciate you taking me through this. Now, tell everybody your websites and your social media and all this good stuff.
You can find us online at timberlandinvestmentgroup.com. We are on LinkedIn as BTG Pactual Timberland Investment Group.
What's the best way for people to contact you?
You can find me on our website.
Well, Charlotte, thanks again.
Thank you, Scott. This is a real pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to SRI 360. If you enjoyed it, please hit the like button and subscribe to get future episodes. You can find an archive of all previous podcast interviews and more articles and information on SRI, ESG, impact investing, sustainable investing, and socially responsible investing at our website, SRI360.com. If you'd like to read more lessons learned from world-class SRI investors, get a copy of Scott Arnell's book, Sustainable and Responsible Investing 360. It's a must-read for anyone wanting to know more about investing for positive social, environmental, and ethical impact. All with market financial returns. These are the stories and tactics of those leading the way as sustainable and responsible investing goes mainstream. Sustainable and Responsible Investing 360 is now available in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook format wherever books are sold.